Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. It turns out that now some atheists want to organize themselves into something like a church. This has led to a big disagreement among atheists. The background of this, of course, is the emergence of the new atheism, as it's called, this very assertive kind of a mediagenic liberalism in the form of atheism out there that's really getting a lot of attention. This particular atheism, fueled by people like Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, it's getting a lot of attention, and you also have now objective studies, such as that from the Pew Research Center, indicating that the number of people who identify themselves as non-believers is expanding in this country. Still very much a minority, but expanding. But it turns out that many of them, well, at least some of them, want to argue that atheism needs to be reconceived as more of a comprehensive worldview than just the negative belief that there is no God. We're going to be looking at an article at New York Magazine from this week, and we're going to be considering what it means for atheists to be discussing whether or not they need to organize themselves into a church. It's fascinating to see the debate that's taking place in those circles, and quite frankly, it helps to illuminate the distinction between theism and atheism in a whole new way. First, a review of some other issues in the news. United Methodists are in the news. Their general conference, which is held every 4 years, begins April 23rd, just a couple days from now, in Fort Worth, Texas. And what's really interesting about all of this is that United Methodists have been waiting 4 years since they last met together for a conversation about some of the things that right now have been of discussion every year in groups like the Presbyterian Church USA, the Episcopal Church US, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, because those bodies meet more often. So what we're looking at is 4 years of pent-up argument ready to break out in Fort Worth, Texas among United Methodists. Christianity Today and Religion News Service are out with some very interesting articles about this. One of the things they're going to be looking at, and this is perhaps the most controversial issue forced by current events, is whether or not the denomination will allow for transgendered persons to serve as clergy. That issue is going to come up because a Baltimore pastor, now known as Drew Phoenix, now a man, having been a woman, wishes to remain in his pulpit. Now, right now, gender change is not addressed in the church's constitution, and the judicial council ruled on that it is not included in the constitution last October, period. Now, let me just suggest to you that if you were to look back, let's say just go 4 or 5 years back, into the official writings, the documentation, the governing documents of American denominations, would you expect to find anything about transgender persons? In other words, we should expect to find an absence working backwards because it was an issue that had just not been confronted, but it's being now very much at the forefront of many of these debates, and certainly any denomination and any church is eventually going to be feeling something of the pressure on this. Perhaps we should say every denomination and every church, because this issue is now so widespread in the culture, and especially when you have a denomination like this that faces the fact that a pastor has now undergone the sex change operation. So it's not just hypothetical as if should we or should we not confronted with a transgender person ordain them, but what happens when a pastor changes gender? According to Religion News Service, in light of the decision of the Reverend Drew Phoenix to change gender and of the Judicial Council of the Church to say that the whole issue of gender change is not addressed in the church's constitution, conservative Methodists now want to see their church codify that transgender people should not be allowed as clergy. Now, there are some very interesting things to look at here. For instance, there is a group basically functioning as a homosexual advocacy group within the United Methodist Church known as Affirmation. Diane DeLapp, an Affirmation spokeswoman, she is herself a transgender laywoman, formerly was a male pastor in evangelical churches, said this, quote, "The idea that because we are transgender, we can automatically be excluded from the ministry is to me personally offensive," end quote. Now, just think with me for a moment about this. There are two dimensions of this that I see as being of crucial importance. Number one, the issue here has to be faced scripturally. You either believe or you do not believe that gender assigned by God is a part of the goodness of God's creation. You either believe or you do not believe that gender is telling us something as we are created in God's image as either male or female. You either believe or you do not believe that it is thus sinful to change one's gender. I do believe all of those things profoundly. If you do not believe those things, then it is virtually certain that there's a host of other things on which you will not agree with those who agree with the first principle. In other words, you're looking at a huge worldview division here. You're not talking about one issue that's just isolated from all others and is likely to cause division. You're talking about an issue that's likely to cause the same division already experienced in any organization if these issues are being debated. Whether it's same-sex marriage or homosexual clergy, you could go down the list. The issues are basically the same. But what I also want to draw attention to in that statement, let me read it to you again, is by Diane DeLapp, an Affirmation spokeswoman there within the United Methodist Church, a transgender laywoman, formerly a male pastor. She said, the idea that, or he said, depending on how you want to conceive that, said, the idea that because we are transgender, we can automatically be excluded from the ministry is to me personally offensive, end quote. It's the words, to me personally offensive, that I want to draw attention. You know, we are in this postmodern age facing a new morality that comes down to don't offend me. I have a right not to be offended. It comes down to the kind of groupthink you get, that you see. It comes down to political correctness. A lot of the argument for what is now known as political correctness is you have to speak in such a way and act in such a way that you do not offend people. Now, no one should be offensive for the cause of being offensive. But notice here that what this person is construing as offensive is believing that gender matters. And that's where we really have to look at the morality of offense and start realizing that people can claim to be offended on any ground, virtually whatever ground they choose. But translating a truth question to an offensiveness question is the kind of move we have to watch very, very carefully. It can take place in a family discussion. It can take place in a local church discussion. It can take place in an academic discussion. In other words, being offended by an idea is a far less consequential question than is the statement true. If you hear a statement said and you say, I don't like that, well, not liking it tells us something about you. The issue, first and foremost, is whether the statement is true, if it's qualified to be true or false. The other big issue coming out about the United Methodist Church, and again, this is beginning on April 23rd in Fort Worth, Texas, in terms of the General Conference, is that a constitutional change is being considered that would create basically a United Methodist Church in an autonomous region in the United States. That is to reduce the amount of international Methodist influence on the United Methodist Church. Now, why you say, would they want to do that? Well, I guarantee you it's not conservatives who want to do that. You look at every one of these denominations. You look especially at the Episcopal Church USA and the Anglican Communion. Where is the conservative influence found? It is found primarily in the Global South, as it is known, where you have units, churches affiliated with the Anglican Communion who are unquestionably conservative, who are adamantly convinced that homosexuality is a sin, who believe that the churches of the advanced economies, especially in Europe and in the United States, are hopelessly heretical and compromised because of the denial of clear biblical truth. It isn't good news, therefore, that as Jim Jones is reporting from Fort Worth, there are those within the United Methodist Church that are seeking to reduce, if not eliminate, this kind of international influence because it is a conserving force or a form of force and influence for conservatism that they want to be without. In California, proponents of a ban on gay marriage, that is a proposed constitutional amendment, now believe they have enough signatures to qualify the measure for the November ballot. The project is known as Project Marriage, and groups affiliated with this movement have collected more than 1.1 million signatures. Brian Brown, executive director of the California Office of the National Organization for Marriage, reports that it's time to get this on the ballot. The initiative, according to the California Constitution, requires 694,000 signatures. That comes down to 8% of the votes cast in the last governor's race to make it onto the ballot. Whenever you have this kind of signature process, you have to have a means of qualifying the signatures to know if they are legitimate, assuming that certainly within that 1.1 million signatures, over 694,354 legitimate signatures can be found. The people of California will have an opportunity once again to vote on a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. Now, what's really interesting is that California voters have already spoken to this. There is a law on the books there. So why is this necessary? Because a law can be changed. Because there is the fear that the California High Court will eventually do what other courts have done and simply rule that that law, which was an initiative by voters there in California years ago, is simply unconstitutional. This effort would amend the Constitution to remove that argument. We'll be following with you along with events in the United Methodist Church and elsewhere. When we come back, we're going to talk about why some atheists think they need to create an atheist church.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. It's very interesting to watch the kind of argument that takes place among non-believers, especially those that are very agitated and organized, such as the new atheists. We're talking here about those figures who are selling books by the thousands. They're getting a lot of media exposure as well, names like Daniel Dennett of Tufts University, Richard Dawkins of Oxford University, Christopher Hitchens, well-known author, and Sam Harris of Stanford University, another very well-known author. They are often referred to now as the four horsemen of the new atheism, kind of a very interesting construct that reminds us that these four personalities really have largely driven the kind of media attention recently given to atheism. When it's called the new atheism, it's not like all of a sudden there's something new in the very conception of atheism. It's called the new atheism because of the kind of argument they bring. They're bringing an argument not just that it is not necessary to believe in God, they're bringing the argument that it's dangerous or evil, not only unjustified to believe that there is a God. Now, what's really interesting behind all of that is the question as to whether there is a groundswell. In other words, just because people are buying books written by these atheists doesn't mean that Americans are all of a sudden embracing atheism. But without taking the book sales and all the rest into direct equation, it is very interesting that the Pew Research Center and other major research organizations are indicating that the fast-growing group, one of the very fastest in terms of American religion, are those who identify themselves as none of the above, or as unbelievers, even as atheists and agnostics. New York Magazine is one of those very interesting barometers of the culture. We're not talking here about the New Yorker. That's more of a literary magazine, but rather New York Magazine. New York Magazine is, well, it's the flagship periodical of popular culture in the nation's most populous city. In New York, New York Magazine tells you what's cool in fashion, what's really trendy in terms of education, what's going on in terms of the celebrity culture. But it also has, as we have mentioned on this program several times, very perceptive articles of cultural analysis. One of them is out right now, this week, at New York Magazine. Author Sean McManus tells of a resurgent atheism and of the fact that there are some atheists who now think they need a church. It seems that some atheists want to form something like a church of unbelief. They want something of the trappings of religion, to use the words of one of the new atheists. They want a church for non-believers. Now, as McManus makes very clear in his article, this isn't the first time something like this has been tried. He takes us back to 1877 with the founding in New York of what was known and is known now as the Society for Ethical Culture. It itself was a society, kind of modeled itself after a church. In 1910, they built on Central Park a huge facility with an auditorium that looks a lot like a church. In terms of programming and education and all the rest, they act much like a church, but they don't believe that there is a God. So it's more or less an atheist, a more humanist kind of organization. Many people have referred to their building on Central Park as a secular cathedral. As McManus explains, the organization's patrons did not believe in God, but they were worried, and I'm quoting here, that society might fall apart if it didn't have a church, end quote. You see, that's one of the anxieties held by some of the new atheists, or at least by some of the atheists who consider themselves emboldened by the new atheists. What if denying the existence of God isn't enough to create a universe of meaning? Now, I have to come back as a Christian theologian and say, well, it isn't enough. The very fact that some of them are beginning to awaken to that is one indication of the poverty of the atheist worldview. The atheist worldview begins with the assumption that there is no God. Where it goes from there, I would argue, is entirely arbitrary. Because if you do not start your worldview with the existence of the self-revealing God, you've got to start it somewhere, and that somewhere is, well, in all likelihood, going to be you. And your worldview is going to be established in a way that is almost entirely intellectually arbitrary. Back in 1910, the Ethical Culture Society there in New York built its secular cathedral. They felt that there needed to be something of the symbolism of a church, something of the trappings of a church, in order to maintain a social structure, more or less. Now, I have to interject myself into this tale for just a moment and say, I think that's what you ended up with much of liberal Protestantism. I mean, one of the things I have to wonder about is why atheists think they need to establish a church. You go to a community, if you look at a Unitarian Universalist church, as it calls itself, it doesn't require belief in God. I was talking not long ago to someone in the United Church of Christ, the most liberal of the liberal Protestant denominations, and it's clear that some of the people this person said in his own church don't believe in God, but they're fully welcome. And as a matter of fact, I think you could argue that liberal Protestantism has been a way of embracing unbelief to some extent, whether you want to classify it as doubt or revisionist theology or open denial of truths revealed in the scripture. To whatever extent you want to define this, liberal Protestantism has been moving in the direction the atheists seem to want. If you want all the trappings, if you want to have a quote, church wedding, if you want to have stained glass and Gothic architecture, you don't need an atheist church. There are plenty of liberal Protestant churches where you don't have to believe in God to be right at home anyway. And that's not to say that all liberal Protestants don't believe in God. It is to say that many of them actually pride themselves, advertise themselves, put on national advertising campaigns saying you're welcome whether you believe in God or not. Well, the atheists are double-minded about this. As a matter of fact, you have some people saying, much like the Ethical Culture Society of old, we need to have an atheist church. While you have others who say, look, that's what we gave up. That's what we don't want. Daniel Dennett said the last thing atheists want to see is their rational set of ideas yoked up with the trappings of a religion. We think we can do without that. End quote. Now, I want to read to you what I think is the most revealing statement in this entire article. It comes from Greg Epstein. He is the humanist chaplain of Harvard University. In other words, an agnostic or atheist chaplain at Harvard University, recognized by the university. So far as I know, this was the very first humanist chaplain established at an American university. But nonetheless, Greg Epstein is that chaplain. He evidently believes that this move for something like an atheist church or a humanist church could be helpful. He says this. Now listen, he says, Science and reason are important, but science and reason won't visit you in the hospital. All right, so let's talk about that for a moment. If you are a non-believer or an unbeliever, an agnostic or an atheist, and you are in the hospital, according to Greg Epstein, the humanist chaplain at Harvard University, the problem is that atheism is cold comfort because science and reason don't come to visit you if those indeed are what I would have to characterize. He wouldn't, but I'll characterize as the idols of the system. Then they're going to come visit you in the hospital. Well, what if another atheist comes to visit you in the hospital? At the beginning of this article in New York Magazine, Sean McManus writes of Richard Dawkins in a recent speaking event where Richard Dawkins makes fun of the argument that religion is important because it gives people solace as they face death. Richard Dawkins, perhaps the world's most famous atheist and evolutionist, said, "Isn't that a little childish?" You see, I think Greg Epstein's exactly right that science and religion won't visit you in the hospital. I just have to wonder, is it going to do you much good? Is there going to be much comfort if an atheist visits you in the hospital, maybe even wearing some kind of atheist clerical garb? You see, there are those within atheism whose desire for a church, I think, tells us that whether they want to deny it or not, they're desiring a whole lot more. I'd like to know what you think about this. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. What do you make of the atheist church? Give me a call at 877-893-TALK, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. I find this whole story very revealing. It's interesting that New York Magazine found it important enough to put it in the magazine, this issue. It's also very interesting that I think it tells us something that as Christians, we need to know. We need to think very clearly about this. Those atheists, those who identify themselves as atheists, as non-believers, who believe that they would benefit by some of the trappings of what they call religion, you have to wonder, is this not telling them that they're not satisfied with their atheism? One of the interesting aspects of the story by Sean McManus is that he indicates, and this is not particularly new, but it's fascinating here, that a good number of these atheists want to redefine atheism so that it's not merely negative. They complain that atheism is too often construed just in the negative, that it's all about not believing in God, and they instead want to create a more comprehensive belief system that would include something like recognizing human dignity and all the rest. But I have to come back and say, I think the reason that's going to fail is, number one, I don't think atheists are ever going to agree on those things. Now, why do theists agree on those things? Why do Christians agree on those things? Well, we agree on those things because we have a scripture that reveals those things. We are tied to that scripture. We are to be submitted to that scripture. We are to receive that scripture as the word of God. And so because of that, we have a commonality on these issues. Certainly when it comes to, for instance, that we are as human beings made in the image of God. But if you're an atheist, your starting point could be completely different. You get two atheists in a room, you could have three different starting points. I think the other reason why it won't work is because you've got to develop a belief system if you're going to try to do what they're going to try to do out of nothing. I mean, if you don't believe in God, then what is it you believe in? Well, you can believe in yourself, in the operation of your own brain. You can believe that there are human beings with whom you're sharing this planet. You can believe that the cosmos was a great accident. But carving out a whole lot of meaning out of that is going to be very, very difficult, as this experiment with atheism has demonstrated. But, you know, they do want some of the trappings. At least some of them do. Daniel Dennett says he doesn't. He says, we don't need any of that. He says the last thing atheists should need or should want to see is, and these are his words, their rational set of ideas yoked up with the trappings of a religion. We think we can do without that, he says. Also, Richard Dawkins says he doesn't want anything to do with this. But, you know, I think there are a lot of people who do. Sean McManus mentioned New York's Ethical Culture Society. He mentions it not only in terms of what it was in the past, but what it is today. It's kind of an example of this. Listen to this. Founded by Felix Adler, the son of a rabbi, to drive social justice initiatives and promote good without God, Ethical Culture walks like a church and talks like a church. Congregates sit in pews, rise to sing hymns, and pass around a collection plate. But at one of their Sunday morning meetings in January, their senior leader, in a very unchurch-like fashion, cited agnosticism as the only intellectually defensible religious position. More to the point, Epstein is eyeing the group's building. That's one of these trying to push the idea of having the spread of this movement as a prototype for the Church of New Humanism. Modeled on a Greco-Roman Colosseum, Ethical Culture has semicircular pews to promote conversation and a low stage designed to minimize the distance between leader and congregation. So you have a form here of a kind of architectural humanism. And I put up at my article at albertmohler.com, posted this morning, not only an article entitled The Church for Atheists with a question mark, but also a photograph of the auditorium here of the Ethical Culture Society and what it looks like from the platform. I really would just love to know what you're thinking of this, because this is not only in New York City. This kind of proposal, it's really showing up elsewhere as well. The phone number to join the conversation, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Clayton, Kansas, where Pam's on the line, listening on XM170. Go ahead, Pam.
Hi, yes. Hi, Mr. Mohler. I was just going to say, you're right dead on. I think that this movement goes to show that even atheists feel like they need something more than just themselves.
You know, I think it would be pretty cold comfort, Pam, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think... frankly, that when an atheist might think that he or she wants to be visited in the hospital by an atheist, maybe that's one of the things that an atheist church could provide. You just have to wonder, what can he say when he gets there? I mean, you look at Richard Dawkins' comment that begins the article at New York Magazine. You can go to my website and find the link from my article this morning. Go read it for yourself. I mean, Richard Dawkins more or less says only weak people, you know, would need something like that. It's something we can do without. Well, then what does he say to someone who's dying? You know, just do it. He says death doesn't matter all that much anyway. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Back with your calls in just a moment.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
You know, we really sometimes do reveal ourselves. Oftentimes, Christians reveal by some of our comments. You hear Christians or those who identify themselves as Christians say things that really would make more sense if they were atheists. And then you hear atheists say things that would make more sense if they were believers, which is to say that one of the problems in this fallen world is inconsistency. But it certainly looks inconsistent when you have those who claim to be atheists or, in milder form, agnostics, who come back to say, look, we need some of the trappings of religion. Now, one of the interesting things about this is that people tend to want this kind of religious structure for their children. Parents tend to be incredibly concerned about this. That's why even in mainline Protestantism, you often have parents in the recent generation, baby boomer parents, who will bring their children and teenagers back because they want them to have the benefit of being in church, whatever they think those benefits are. But it's really interesting. If you're an atheist parent, what do? There isn't really very easily, found probably in every neighborhood, an atheist Sunday school. So maybe these atheists, certainly as their numbers increase, they will, let's band ourselves together. There are others who want nothing to do with that. For instance, Ellen Johnson, president of the group known as American Atheists, said, and I quote, "Our members have left religion and don't want any part of that." When John McManus takes us into the auditorium at the Ethical Culture Society in New York, notice the things that he said takes place there. He says, look, it looks like a church, smells like a church, walks like a church, quacks like a church. He says, look, they sit in pews when they're in the church, in this building. They rise to sing hymns, and they pass around a collection plate. Now, let's think about this for a moment. The pews, I can understand, they're just mimicking a church structure. The rise to sing hymns? What in the world are they singing? I want that hymnal. Just write it down. I want the Ethical Culture Society hymnal. I want to know what those hymns look like. But it is really interesting. You know, every movement has to have music. Whether it's the Communist Revolution in 1917 or the American Revolution with Yankee Doodle, every movement has got to have music. But I want to know what the Ethical Culture Atheist, Humanist, Agnostic hymnal sounds like. And they pass an offering plate. Well, I guess I can understand how that works. But what do they do in a time of, say, spiritual need? It was the humanist chaplain at Harvard University who said, look, the problem is that science and religion won't visit you in the hospital. And I just want to ask honestly, I don't mean this just trying to rub salt in a wound or to be offensive. I just don't know what one atheist says to another atheist in the hospital. Sounds like a setup for a bad joke. I mean, what do you say? What does an atheist say to another atheist in the face of terminal illness? Good luck? Now, again, I think that's the problem. I think that the very fact that they want these trappings indicates that there is a nagging knowledge within them that there has to be more to this than the atheism they say they embrace. But if they actually do try to create something like an atheist church, I think, well, at that point, I'm going to be with Richard Dawkins. Good luck. How are you going to pull that off? Because what are you going to say? What are you going to do? What hymns are you going to sing? What's the Sunday school curriculum going to look like for the kids? Interestingly enough, something like that was proposed not long ago. It doesn't look like it's fast catching on across the country. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. There's more to it in this story, of course. Richard Dawkins says, in the larger war against supernaturalism, frankly, it doesn't help to fraternize with the enemy. End quote. I love that. Here you have Richard Dawkins identifying us as the enemy and saying, let's not fraternize with the enemy. Let's not look like we're more religious than we are. Well, I can respect that part of his argument. But I don't think anyone's going to confuse Richard Dawkins as a closet believer. Daniel Dennett at Tufts University, another one of the well-known four horsemen of the new atheism, said about all of this, we can simply do without that. I think we can do without that. Now, my argument is that no one is fooled by a secular cathedral. In other words, you can have the architecture, you can have a pipe organ, you can have a choir loft and a choir, you can have a hymn book and hymns, you can have the collection plate, you can have ushers at the door and pews where people sit. Or for that matter, if you want to be a contemporary, seeker-sensitive atheist church, I guess you could have, you know, acoustical music and mood lighting and all the rest. Whatever you have, I just don't know what in the world you're going to say. Bill's calling. Listen to WFIA. Bill, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm calling from Louisville. I've been listening to the program. I'm very well read on the likes of Daniel Dennett and Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and such people. And I just, as I'm listening to you, I'm realizing how much you're misstating their viewpoint. What they're really saying is that there is, they look at religious gatherings and see value in the fellowship of it and the altruistic acts behind it, but they're not embracing the mythology and things that can't be proved with naturalistic explanations. And I don't think you're giving it a fair definition in your explaining and using the word of the trappings.
Well, that's their word. I'm reading from an article. That's exactly what they're talking about, and as I indicated, the atheists are divided on this, and if you've been listening, you know, I've clearly said Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett want nothing of this. They've spoken very clearly to it. Let's not fraternize with the enemy. And they're not alone. Some of the older atheist leaders, in fact, I think Ellen Johnson, president of American Atheists, has been at it 11 years, according to the article. She says our members have left religion and don't want any part of that. That's from the article by Sean McManus, New York Magazine. The interesting thing is that some atheists, however, Bill, are saying, look, we want trappings, and they don't mean just altruistic acts and fellowship. They're talking about something more organized. That's why Sean McManus looks at the Ethical Culture Society in New York and says, look, that's why he finds it interesting that there's a group that would have pews and a hymn book and a collection plate and all the rest. And, you know, Bill, I assume you would assume that's kind of church-ish in terms of the culture. So I find it very interesting. I think at least those atheists, and you're certainly free to disagree with me, and I appreciate your call. I think at least those atheists are betraying the fact that they want something more than what their atheism can fulfill. And, you know, even when it comes, I'd love to continue this discussion if we had time, even when it comes to the fellowship, I guess I can understand how that would work. The altruistic acts, you know, I guess, you know, certainly you could come up with some kind of conception for that. But at the end of the day, what seems to be behind this article by Sean McManus is, what do you do when facing a question like death? And that's where, at least he helps us to see, there's even a difference of opinion among atheists or agnostics or however they want to characterize themselves as non-believers. Back with more in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. I appreciate the conversation. We'll be tracking this story and kind of looking at what's happening. Some time back, there was a news story about some atheist parents wanting to create an atheist Sunday school for children because they wanted their children to have the structure and to learn some form of moral reasoning in context with other children. So it's very interesting, something of a parallel story going on here. I want to draw your attention to the fact that my book coming out this summer entitled Atheism Remix, The Challenge of the New Atheism. It's going to be out from Crossway Books in this summer. It's already up at Amazon.com. You can find it there. And I'll be telling you more about how you can get a hold of that in coming weeks. It is really interesting right now to ponder something that's going on in politics. Of course, today is the Pennsylvania primary at long last, and especially on the Democratic side, There is fervent hope among many different and opposing quarters that this will bring some clarity to the 2008 race for the Democratic presidential nomination. But the New York Times is out with a very interesting article today indicating that politicians are beginning to really rely for touch with the customer, so to speak, with the voter, by going on popular television shows and especially pop TV entertainment with comics. The writer of this article goes out of his way to remind us that it was in 1992 that President Bill Clinton, it was she, Alexandra Stanley, who usually writes some fascinating stuff for the New York Times, she writes that it's hard for us to remember now how shocking it was in 1992 when then candidate Bill Clinton went on the Arsenio Hall show and played, now quite iconically, his saxophone. In the year 2000, George W. Bush went on Oprah to reveal that his favorite sandwich is peanut butter and jelly on white bread. Now you have virtually all these candidates showing up not only on the evening shows and the late night shows, but also on the cable television shows. So you got The Daily Show, and you have the Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert shows. And then, of course, you have the entertainers, especially with late night television. As Ms. Stanley says, in politics, as in show business, too many appearances can weaken their value. All three candidates taped appeals for donations for a special star-studded episode of American Idol this month. All three were bumped by bigger stars. That tells you something. But nonetheless, they feel like they have to go there. And just recently, President George W. Bush made the first appearance on something like this by an incumbent president when he taped a special cameo appearance for Monday's episode of an NBC program. That tells you something about the direction of politics. It tells you something also about the power, the incredible power of pop culture within America. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. It's Ask Anything Wednesday. We'll talk about what's on your mind, and I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.